This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.
Anh xuống mau.
Rồi nha.
Mau.
Em đã.
Em.
The controversial, iconic, and indeed terrifying Russian roulette scene from the film The Deer Hunter. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on Newstalk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. And in tonight's show, we're looking at a cinematic classic from 1978, a film about life in America and the war in Vietnam, which has been called both a modern masterpiece and a racist account of the conflict. Tonight's show is on The Deer Hunter. We'd love you to take part in our discussion, so text us at any time on 53106, that's for 30 cents, or call us on our local 1890 number, 453106, or email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week we looked at the life and legacy of Gertrude Bell, an extraordinary woman who has been called the maker of modern Iraq. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, I was forgetting the new address, or go directly to iTunes. Now, tonight's debate is on The Deer Hunter. Starring Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, and a young Meryl Streep, The Deer Hunter was released in December 1978 and won 5 Academy Awards in the spring of 1979, including one for Best Picture and one for Walken as Best Supporting Actor. However, there was some controversy on the night of the awards, with protesters calling the film a bloody lie and insisting on no Oscars for racism. Directed by Michael Cimino, who won the award for Best Director, The Deer Hunter is a 3-hour-long epic which tells the story of a group of friends from western Pennsylvania who get caught up in the Vietnam War and who are traumatized in different ways by their experiences. The crucial event is their time as prisoners of the Viet Cong, where they are forced to play Russian roulette for their lives. The use of Russian roulette proved highly controversial because it was not historically accurate, but defenders of the film claim that it represented a deeper truth about war and trauma. Or, as Robert De Niro put it, all's fair in love and war. Some critics described it at the time as one of the most emotionally shattering films ever made. A big, awkward, crazily ambitious motion picture that comes as close to being a popular epic as any since The Godfather. Cimino was briefly the hero of Hollywood, but his next film, Heaven's Gate, was a massive flop and his career never really recovered. Among the movies he planned to make, but never did, was one on the Irish leader Michael Collins. So in tonight's show we want to look at the film The Deer Hunter and assess its place in American cinematic history. Does it deserve its reputation as a modern masterpiece? Or is it a rambling, self-indulgent barf fest steeped in racist emotion, as one recent critic has alleged? And so to help me debate The Deer Hunter, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Stephen Benedict is a writer, broadcaster and award-winning filmmaker and is an expert on film history. His website, stephenbenedict.ie, gives an insight into his range of activities, and that's spelled Stephen with a V. Dr. Con Holohan is the Assistant Director of Research and Development at the Houston School of Film and Digital Media at NUI Galway, named after, of course, the iconic and legendary film director John Huston. And Dr. Con Holohan's books include Cinema on the Periphery, Contemporary Irish and Spanish Film. Philip Malloy is the presenter of The Picture Show on News Talk on Saturdays from 6 to 7 and is an expert on cinema and cinematic history. And I tell you, no show about film history would be the same without the presence of Philip Malloy. Well, you're all very welcome. Later in the show, I'll also be talking to Professor Dana Polan, who lectures on cinema studies at NUI in New York and who is the author of 8 books on film and media, including one on The Sopranos, and as well as he's also the author of 200 essays and reviews. Well, Stephen, we might begin with you, and we might begin with the director of The Deer Hunter, Michael Cimino, because he seems to be a fairly elusive and enigmatic figure. He claimed to have fought and served in Vietnam with the Green Berets, but that seems to be a complete lie. He claimed to have been just, I think, 24 when he was making The Deer Hunter.
He did the Zsa Zsa Gabor thing. Yeah.
He was actually an awful lot older.
Yeah.
I think he was closer to 40. He was and is an unreliable figure.
Yeah, he's doing what a lot of young directors in Hollywood did in the 70s and still do today, is they created an aura about themselves and create a legend about themselves. And when it emerged that The Deer Hunter was suddenly in the running for the Academy Awards, he told this little Porky about his age, because he wanted to become the youngest director ever to win the Academy Award. I think the bigger lie and the more problematic lie was the fact that he claimed that he had served in Vietnam. He said that he served with the Green Berets medical unit in the Tet Offensive in 68, when in actual fact he had never served in Vietnam in any way, in any capacity at all. He had trained with the Green Berets medical unit in Texas in 1962. And that was part, I think, you know, we could say that that's just simply gossip behind the making of the film. As I said, many directors inflate stuff, but I think it feeds into the lie of the film. It is undoubtedly, it's a landmark picture. It's a very, very important picture. But put the cards on the table, I think it's as bad and as racist as The Birth of a Nation. This movie tells a phenomenal offence, a racial offence towards the Vietnam people. And it portrays the white American soldier as the sole victim of the Vietnam conflict. The way that the American soldiers are subjected to this brutal Russian roulette sequence, as you said, it was completely unfounded. It shows that the Viet Cong, it portrays them as complete savages, and they deserved everything that they got. Carpet bombing, napalm, Agent Orange, the Mae Lai massacre, you name it, they were deserving of it. And it presents, as I said, the American soldier as the sole victim of it. And in terms of the way that Cimino made the movie, as you said, the criticism of it saying it was very self-indulgent and long. Technically, it's a superb film. The problem is that they decided to present the Russian roulette sequence as a metaphor for Vietnam. But the style that Michael Cimino used to make the movie was naturalism. Okay, it's almost like a documentary, the way he delivers, especially the opening hour, the wedding scene. And what he was doing was he was quoting directly from his two cinematic idols, Luchino Visconti and Akira Kurosawa, who are two superb filmmakers who have a very, very clear understanding about the emergence and the importance of history in the contemporary arena. And Cimino had none of that. And I think that's the reason why the film fails utterly from the end.
Yeah, I watched the film again last night, and I'd like to thank my friend Alistair. He lent me the movie on DVD about 5 years ago, and I still have never returned it. But I suppose I could kind of agree with you, but maybe also disagree with you. You know, it's a complex one. The Russian roulette thing wasn't historically accurate, but did it not point to a deeper truth about how you can be traumatized by war and the effects that we do know that the ones who were prisoners of the North Vietnamese did come back scarred and physically and mentally. So in a way, was it not legitimate to have this as a metaphor?
No, simply you can't. Because as I said to you, his approach was naturalism. I think the thing is, you got to just bring us back to where the movie actually began. It began as a short story called The Man Who Came to Play. And it was Lou Garfinkel and Quinn K. Radonek who came up with this idea about men who played Russian roulette for a living. And they played it in Las Vegas. And it came to Michael Dealy, a great British producer who'd made The Man Who Fell to Earth and The Italian Job. And he then got in touch with Michael Cimino. And Cimino was looking around and says, where can we legitimately get a character to play Russian roulette for a living? And Vietnam became the place. So it was a metaphor, yes. But then, as I said to you, he transposes that with naturalism. And naturalism and metaphor are not easy bedfellows. And that's the reason why the film fails. And I think that's the reason why the Russian roulette sequence is incredibly powerful, incredibly visceral. But the reason why it works is because audiences had never seen American soldiers subjected to such humiliation and degradation in cinema before. And that was the reason why it hit home.
Philip, that is extraordinary, really, that based on an idea for something set in Las Vegas to do with gambling, and then they suddenly stick on Vietnam to it, and it becomes something quite different.
Well, I don't think there was any stick on. First of all, by the way, on the naturalism, the deer hunter idea is a metaphorical idea as well. So the whole basis of the movie, in some ways, is metaphorical. The thing about Cimino, I agree with Stephen on this. I don't know if we're going to ever able to call him a liar or not, but he's certainly unreliable. Last night I looked at the commentary on the DVD that you referred to, and all through it he tries to push himself, and he tries to over-represent himself, as far as I can tell. And the thing about him is that he goes back, though. Stephen has referred to what he said, what the claims about being in Vietnam. Apparently he got some sort of medical training, or he took some sort of medical training, and he said that that's what he did. This is what he said now on the DVD, which is from 2003, I think it is. It's a Blu-ray DVD, and he said that he never went to Vietnam, but this is he was apparently accomplished enough to be able to look at some of the problems that the guys had from a medical perspective. Now that was the way he was putting it.
Earlier he had said he had been there after the Tet Offensive.
Now, but I certainly don't understand this from Stephen, who is a film buff, this business of one feeding into the other. I mean, there are filmmakers have made all kinds of claims down the years, and they've still gone on to make absolutely wonderful movies. I think this is a powerful movie. I would say, by the way, about the Russian roulette, again, it's metaphorical, and I think it's a representation, a metaphorical sort of representation of the dehumanizing effects of war. I think, you know, that's as tightly as you can put it.
Okay, we'll return to some of the controversies, but let's talk about the casting, because there really was an incredible cast in that movie. Robert De Niro was, I suppose, the only really famous person. Yeah. Meryl Streep wasn't very well known. Christopher Walken and Cimino, incredible.
Yeah, Cimino actually, again, Cimino took credit there where I don't think he was due the credit. One of the things that Michael Dealey says, that Stephen referred to him, Michael Dealey was the boss of EMI, and EMI was the British company that acquired the spec script that Stephen referred to, the man who came to play, and he was the guy, and EMI were the people who initiated the movie, because basically there was no interest in the Hollywood system at that time of making movies about Vietnam. But anyway, to go back to the casting, Dealey approached Cimino, but he also approached Robert De Niro. He decided that they needed a big star like that. So they approached Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro was interested from the beginning. The thing about De Niro was he seemed to know absolutely everything that was happening on the New York stage. So what they did was they got Meryl Streep, who's wonderful in it. They got Christopher Walken, and they got John Cazale. They got all of these true Robert De Niro, because he knew them, he had seen them, he knew what was happening with them, and they all had stories of their own. As you know, John Cazale was Meryl Streep's boyfriend at the time, but he was dying of cancer.
And people, if they haven't seen The Deer Hunter, might know him as Fredo from The Godfather 1 and 2.
Yeah,
and
he was dying of bone cancer at the time, all true. And what they had to do was to shoot his scenes at the beginning of the film. Again, he was discovered by De Niro. And there is a suggestion, I don't know if it's true or not, that they had to get insurance for him to keep him on in the film. And there is a suggestion that De Niro actually paid for
the
insurance.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Stephen, let's talk about the casting. I'll bring in Con then about the context for the film in terms of the 1970s. But John Cazale, a really extraordinary actor, a brilliant actor.
A phenomenal actor. I mean, let's just list his films. The Godfather, The Godfather 2, The Conversation, Dog Day Afternoon, The Deer Hunter.
And nothing else.
He died before The Deer Hunter was premiered. And so five films, five of them were nominated for the Academy Award, three of them won Best Picture, not solely because of John Cazale's presence, but when you look at the guy and you see how incredibly textured his support character was in each of those films. He never played the lead, but he brought such phenomenal humanity and gravitas to every one of his roles.
Yeah, it should be said, I think he's about 42 when he made this movie.
Right.
But he had a huge history on the stage before that too. He was very well respected.
One thing I read, and I don't know if this is true, that the Meryl Streep character had very little dialogue in the script, but they were so impressed with her that there was a lot of ad-libbing and she wrote her own lines.
Yeah, he told her to improvise apparently, yeah. And that's where it came from.
You see, and the thing is that, you know, Dealey made a great choice by approaching De Niro. And not only De Niro knew everybody, but everybody knew De Niro and everybody loved him and they regarded him because he won the Academy Award for The Godfather Part 2. He just appeared in Taxi Driver. And he went around in the summer of, I think it was the summer of 1976, and he went around New York Theatre's district and he picked out this phenomenal talent. Cimino claimed that he cast, but the thing is, Meryl Streep years later attributes her casting solely to Robert De Niro. And the important thing is that De Niro then conducted workshops with all the cast to get the characters up on their feet because the story was pretty much threadbare. At the time, it was a very, very loose plot, but they didn't have characterization. And it was De Niro who drove the performances in the film.
Con, would you be able to situate the movie then for us in the context of what was going on in Hollywood in the 1970s? Would it have been normal to have had a 3-hour epic like The Deer Hunter to have given the director so much control and really to have done it in the way that it was approached?
Well, I guess what's incredible looking back now is that a director who it was his second film was given the power to make this big 3-hour film, go off to Thailand, shoot these scenes, and, you know, given the level of creative control. But as you say, the context in which it occurs is the 1970s, in which, well, depending on who you listen to, it's this brief flowering period of creativity in Hollywood, or else it's a moment in which the studios were essentially in decline and searching around desperately for a way to revitalize their fortunes, because in the 1960s, basically, the big studios were still being run by some of the guys who'd been at the top all the way back in the 40s. They were increasingly out of touch with youth culture, with a lot of the changes that were happening in American society. And there was a series of costly flops, films like Tora, 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 and Hello, Dolly, which basically saw the studios kind of grasping about, looking for a way to find an audience. So it was in that context that filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola and Scorsese came along and were given a chance to make films that in many ways challenged a lot of the structure and the storytelling style of some of the earlier films. And these were guys who had grown up watching European cinema of the 50s and 60s, Godard, Francois Truffaut. They'd gone to film school. They were really the first directors to come out of film school rather than learning their trade in the studio on the lot. And so they arrived at a time when the studios were open to fresh blood, essentially. And so, yeah, it's in that context that someone like Cimino can come along and create a story like this. And well, it becomes even more obvious, and we're jumping ahead a little bit, but when we see the kind of creative freedom he had in Heaven's Gate, which ultimately more or less sank a film studio.
And Con, it's interesting when you look at it, you know, even say that opening first hour that Stevens mentioned, the wedding scene, I almost can't believe that you would have something like that now. It would be edited and cut down to maybe 20 minutes. And maybe watching it now, it does seem a bit self-indulgent or excessive. But Stevens suggested
it'd be done in 3 minutes. It'd be the pre-credit sequence in the film.
Yeah. You know? Well, Stephen, maybe I'll go to you on that. Was it self-indulgent?
No, I think for me, the opening hour is one of the strongest parts of the film. My main problem is when they go to Vietnam. I think, as I said, technically it's a superb film. His decision to get the camera well back from the action and let the actors and let the scenes unfold in a natural time, I think is superb because it's very, very immersive. And then if you think about the manner in which the movie literally catapults you straight into Vietnam, you have George Zunza playing the beautiful Chopin Nocturne,
yeah.
And then you hear the of the helicopters and boom, you're straight into this village. But I think another thing that what I really find amazing about the film, and this is a testimony to Cimino's talent as a director when he had it. If you look at it very carefully, at the beginning of the movie, Robert De Niro is visually on the periphery of the frame a lot of the time. And gradually, slowly but surely, over the course of 3 hours, he comes to sit in the center of the movie. And I think that is very, very good filmmaking. The film is, in many ways, despite its very, very heavy-handedness, it is remarkably subtle in its storytelling technique. Mm. It doesn't go in for close-ups that much. It allows you to pick off the little tapestries, the little vignettes that are happening on either side of the frame, and it works as an accumulator effect.
And for
Patrick,
those...
Could I, yes, yeah, sorry, just, Philip, just yeah. In terms of what you were asking Khan there, movies like Bonnie and Clyde in the late 60s basically started this kind of trend that he was talking about. And the 70s are quite often referred to as the second golden age. That's the second golden age after the 30s in American cinema. So all of these people that he was talking about, Coppola, Scorsese, all of these guys, they all emerged in that period. So he was part of that. One of the things about him was he trained, I think, and was a qualified architect. He's supposed to be quite a good painter as well. This is Cimino. He was looking for ways to break into the cinema. So he wrote or co-wrote a script for a movie called Silent Running, which is very, very well regarded with Bruce Dern. And then he made Magnum Force for Clint Eastwood. And Eastwood apparently liked him, was impressed with him. And then he allowed him to direct Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. And it went on from there. So he had some standing at a time when people were, there were all kinds of great filmmakers around.
Okay, well, we're talking history, and tonight we're talking about The Deer Hunter. We're going to take a very quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring why there were so few movies about Vietnam and whether Deer Hunter changed anything. So come back after the break.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Welcome back. Tonight we're talking about The Deer Hunter with Stephen Benedict, Con Holohan, Philip Malloy, and in a few minutes' time we'll be talking to Dana Pullen. Stephen, let's maybe summarise the movie very quickly for our listeners, because it's I suppose an easy movie to follow. It's because as even that first hour, it's a big wedding and a hunt.
War movies in general are quite easy to follow because the plot is very simple: survive or die. The movie opens in Pennsylvania, and it's set in a steel working town, and a group of young men are all working at the mill. One of them is going to get married. There's a marriage that takes place. They go off on a deer hunting expedition. They come back. They have a few more beers in town. They go off to Vietnam. Terrible things happen. And it's how they recover or don't recover, how they are traumatized by the experience. And then that leads us into the third act, where they're back home again and how they're disconnected from one another, how they're alienated, or how they're trying to come together. And it's as simple as that. I mean, Saving Private Ryan, what does it say? It's they're trying to save Private Ryan.
And the thing that traumatizes them so much is being forced to play Russian roulette.
Yeah.
Christopher Walken can never get over it.
That's right. I mean, the interesting thing is there was an article, really, really interesting article published recently by Sebastian Junger. He's an investigative journalist. And he wrote a really, really interesting piece about post-traumatic stress disorder. And he's coming to the conclusion that post-traumatic stress disorder does not result from war. It is created by our society back home. And he says there are plenty of cultures in which the community will go off to war, the young men will go off to war, and they will come back and they'll be repatriated into the community because the community has gone through the same experience pretty much themselves, because the war is happening on their doorstep. And what's happened with the American experience is increasingly the wars do not happen on the doorstep. They go abroad to fight the war and they come back and the community is completely at a different emotional register to them. And that is one of the strengths of the Deer Hunter. And it's one of the great strengths of other subsequent films from Vietnam, like Apocalypse Now and Platoon.
One of the interesting things about it, by the way, was not a foot of it was actually shot in the film studio. It was all shot on location. And
a lot in Thailand.
In Thailand. on the River Kwai, by the way, the famous River Kwai. But the opening sequence that we were talking about there, he actually shot. He was looking around for steel mills all over the northeast of America, and he shot those opening sequences in seven different towns in four states in America. It was set in a place called Clairton in Pennsylvania, and so in order to get the effect that he got, and it it does come together very, very well.
It is stitched
together really very professionally and very smoothly.
The magazine Vanity Fair had a piece about the making of it and said that they'd rented the helicopters off the Thailand military, and then they needed to take them back for a military coup in the weekend.
What happened more in Apocalypse Now. Francis Ford Coppola didn't get the agreement and the cooperation of the Pentagon.
That was in the Philippines.
And President Marcos was fighting insurgents in the south, and halfway through the Valkyrie
But I
sequence,
think the same thing happens with,
really,
apparently, according to Vanity Fair, the Thailand people and the guy, the military guy, ended up later, a few years later, becoming prime minister.
I've seen that.
I've seen that written.
So it shows that the history was repeating itself in terms of the stuff being used for their own things. Con, can I bring you in about the sense that the movie isn't even so much about Vietnam, it's about, following on from what Stephen was saying, it's about how this affected the people at home, and it's as much about that the community in Pennsylvania as it is about what's going on the ground in Vietnam.
Absolutely. I think ultimately that is what it's about. Christopher Walken said apparently they never really talked about Vietnam when they were making the film. And it's about, as Stephen said, the disjuncture and experience between these men who went off to fight and the people back home. But I think really what the film is about America's sense of itself and its values. And and that's what the films about Vietnam, such as Platoon, Apocalypse Now, ultimately become about. And that's where they're problematic, because they're not really about the Vietnam War to the extent that they're concerned with this event and the causes and effects of it, particularly for the Vietnamese. It's about how the Vietnamese War changed America. And so these men, in a sense, stand in for that. And Michael, in particular, De Niro's character, you know, he is the embodiment of a particular set of values that, you know, when we look at The Deer Hunter, you can very much trace back to the Western genre, for example. You know, even in his code of honor, which is, you know, in the very title of the film, The Deer Hunter, the thing that sets him apart from all his other friends who go shooting is he will only kill the deer with one shot. And so, you know, here, thereby kind of connecting himself to that code of honor of the cowboy who, you know, only draws his gun at the right moment, never shoots someone in the back. So it's about how those values are worked out and worked through and what they mean in America in the 1970s and whether they still mean anything, in fact.
Okay, Philip, the movie came out in December 1978, so the fall of Saigon was 3 years old at that point. How had Hollywood approached Vietnam before that? How many movies had there been?
Well, generally speaking, it had been afraid of Vietnam. And as we were saying earlier, this was actually initiated by a British company, EMI. There was a film called The Green Berets in, I think, about 1968, which was a John Wayne, very much a sort of gung-ho movie and very propagandist, very right-wing sort of propagandist movie. And it was ridiculed at the time. Now, I don't know if that put studios off, but it certainly didn't help. One way or the other, the American studios couldn't sell Vietnam to the public. So as you say, you had the fall of Saigon in 75. And then we had in 78 we had a small clutch, I suppose, of movies. Coming Home, The Boys in Company C, and Go Tell the Spartans. Two of those were very small movies, Go Tell the Spartans and The Boys in Company C. And basically, I suppose the studios involved were taking a punt on them, and they wouldn't have lost much if they hadn't done that well.
There seemed to be some politics between Coming Home and The Deer Hunter, because Jane Fonda and John Voight were in Coming Home, and it was about the relationship between the wife of a serving officer and a man who had been crippled by his experience of Vietnam, but it seemed to be on the anti-war side, and Jane Fonda, because they were both up for Best Picture, there seemed to be some clashes between one being seen as an anti-war,
Jane Fonda was Hanoi Jane, so we know where she was coming from, and I think that Coming Home doesn't really stand up. I like the director Hal Ashby, but I think it's quite a soft movie.
In a sense, Deer Hunter is anti-war as well, because it doesn't glorify, let's
be clear about this. It is an anti-war picture. I mean, Cimino has many faults, but he's not, you know, he doesn't valorize that sort of conflict and that sort of suffering. And Coming Home, I think, is epitomized what Con was saying. It's about America. It's, you know, I don't think anything is set. We don't see any footage from Vietnam. in the film, you know, and we can understand exactly why Jane Fonda was opposed to the
Deer
Hunter, but
best,
to the Oscars.
Stephen, the best thing about it is the performance of Bruce Dern as husband.
Yeah.
He's superb in it.
Okay, perfect. Okay, now earlier in the week, I talked to Professor Dana Polan, who is a lecturer in cinema studies at NYU, New York University. He's an expert on cinema. He's written 8 books on film and media. And I began by asking him about how long it took Hollywood to start talking about Vietnam. And I asked him to talk us through that.
Yes, absolutely. Interestingly, one of the first books that's about Hollywood and Vietnam uses as its title Looking Away. It's a book by Julian Smith, and I've always thought that that title, Looking Away, I think the subtitle is something like Hollywood in Vietnam or Vietnam in Hollywood, something like that. But the main title, Looking Away, is really captures the attitude of Hollywood cinema towards the Vietnam War through the 60s into the 70s. Very few films deal directly with the experience. The only film that talks at any length about Vietnam is a right-wing film by John Wayne, The Green Berets. And generally, you get an avoidance of Vietnam. It's almost as if while the war is going on, America can't really come to grips with the experience in terms of cultural production about it. You need the distance of the end of the war. And then so within a few years, not right away, but 1978, for example, in the case of Deer Hunter, so 3 years after the fall of Saigon, you start to get a wave of films that mention Vietnam. I'm not sure they deal with it in any effective fashion, and we can come back to that.
Yeah, what about Apocalypse Now? Because in a previous show, we looked at that movie, and that also deals with it, but I suppose in a very different way from Deer Hunter.
Well, there's differences, there's also similarities. Interestingly, one of the details that a lot of people don't catch about Apocalypse Now is that it's actually for only part of the story, is it about Vietnam? There's a moment, and it's sort of ambiguous in the film, but there's a moment where they cross over into Cambodia, and the Kurtz's compound is actually not in Vietnam, but across the border. So it's actually even somewhere else than in Vietnam. And I think many of these films, Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, Jacob's Ladder, they're not really interested in explaining or engaging with the politics of war. They're about something else, which I think is more a kind of trauma that happens to American masculinity. So they render war as something mysterious, exotic, horrific, nightmarish, but not really explainable. So for me, that's the similarity. All these films will have scenes set back in the U.S., and then suddenly Vietnam intrudes, and it intrudes almost as a kind of dramatic cut into another reality, as if we've moved from one place to something incomprehensible, something other, something beyond comprehension, beyond belief. Full Metal Jacket will do the same thing much later in the 80s. So we're in the place we know, America, and then suddenly we're thrust into something unfathomable. And these films don't try and make the war experience very fathomable. They try and keep it as something other, something mysterious, something we really can't understand. I mean, one criticism of Deer Hunter, and it's also a criticism that I think you could say of Apocalypse Now and to a certain degree of Full Metal Jacket, is they don't really show the other side in any effective way. There's a kind of barrier of cultures. You often don't see the enemy, or when you see them, there's no translation of their language, and they're treated as fully alien others. They're not of us. They're something else.
And the point you made about how it captures what's going on at home in America and then transports you to Vietnam, Deer Hunter does that very well by showing what life is like in Pennsylvania and then showing the horrors of the war.
Yes. Interestingly, you know, I think most people, if they had to classify Deer Hunter within a genre, they'd talk about it as a Vietnam film. But in fact, if you even do quantitatively look at how much of the film takes place in Pennsylvania and how much takes place overseas, more than the first third of the film is set in Pennsylvania. It's a 3-hour film. Into the second hour, we're still in Pennsylvania. We get about a half an hour, a little more maybe, in Vietnam. Then we go back to Pennsylvania, and we have a slight late scene where Michael goes back to Vietnam to bring Nick home. And then we're back in Pennsylvania again. So actually, very little of the film is directly about Vietnam. It's about life before the trauma of Vietnam and then life after the trauma. For me, the film is not so much a film about Vietnam. It belongs to another genre of films that are very important in the 70s, starting around 76 with Rocky and going on into the 80s, which are films about working class life. And I think that's its real importances, that it's a film about what it means to work in the steel mills, what it means to be have your life spent in bars, and a lot of Deer Hunter takes place in bars. The last scene's in a bar, very early scenes are in a bar. What are the rituals of working-class America? And in the 70s, there's lots of discussion about whether the working class has a future, and this film, I think, is very much about that, like a number of other films at the time.
The use of the Russian roulette sequence proved controversial upon its release because people pointed to the fact that there was no documented evidence of Russian roulette being used by the Viet Cong during the war.
Right. Yeah, again, the film, like Apocalypse Now, is not a film that you would necessarily go to for any kind of historical accuracy, and that goes back to what I was saying before. I think the film is not trying to be about Vietnam or in any way historically engage with the war in Vietnam. Interestingly, there is some documentary footage towards the very end when we see the storming of the embassy in Saigon, but much of it is a kind of fantasy image of what war is, and it's a horrific fantasy image, and it needs to represent the war, again, as something beyond any natural, understandable explanation. So it has to go into this world of the absolutely nightmarish, the absolutely inaccurate in terms of historical fact. It simply wants to represent what happens in Vietnam as a kind of unfathomable, as I said before, an unfathomable terror, a horror. So it fabricates this idea of the Russian roulette because it needs something so beyond belief, so harrowing that it could cause the trauma that these men undergo. And it is a very harrowing sequence. And I think it's hard to watch that part of the film, whatever one thinks of Deer Hunter.
The movie won 5 Academy Awards and did very well at the box office. There was a lot of critical acclaim. But I read that there was a backlash then in the 1980s following the failure of the director's next movie, Heaven's Gate. And some critics began to reevaluate what they thought of Deer Hunter.
Yes, I think Michael Cimino, with Deer Hunter, he had worked on lower-budget genre films before, a film with Clint Eastwood called Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. Deer Hunter was his breakthrough into a kind of serious cinema, at times almost a kind of art cinema. Deer Hunter is filled with all sorts of symbolic moments, the red wine that Steve and his wife, or his bride Angela, drink at their wedding, and then we see a drop get on her dress, and that's going to symbolize bad luck. It's a very arty film. It's a very symbolic film. It's a deliberately slow-moving film. There are heavenly choirs in the sequences where they go up in the hills and try and kill, go hunting, as in the title of the film, become deer hunters. So it has a kind of pretension that then, I think, led to Cimino with Heaven's Gate even becoming more artistically ambitious, and that was such a fiasco, box office-wise, that his career was effectively ruined at that point. He made a few other films, but never with the level of acclaim that he had achieved with Deer Hunter. And I think it has caused people to go back and look at Deer Hunter again. And as I said, I just recently rewatched it. I hadn't watched it since 1978 when it first came out. And a lot of the pretension struck me this time. The slow zooms in and out of everyday life in the Pennsylvania community, the moments of symbolism, moments that seem improbable but are there to deliberately add another layer of meaning. All of those stand out, and I think they stand out because they're so extreme in Heaven's Gate that you can't help but see Cimino already starting to do that in The Deer Hunter.
So how do your fellow film experts view the movie then? Do they share your views that 37 years on, maybe some elements haven't held up well? What's the reputation of the movie now? What's it standing now?
I think it's thought of as, again, a film that was important because it was one of the first films, however confused a fashion, to actually deal with Vietnam after there had been a silence. It's seen as a film that's very important in launching or confirming the career of a number of actors. Christopher Walken, for example, wins Best Supporting Actor. I think other Vietnam films have taken over a reputation as being the definitive or the breakthrough films about representation of the Vietnam War. On the one hand, Apocalypse Now, on the other hand, I think Full Metal Jacket, which is similar in certain ways to Deer Hunter in having this before and after structure, before we get to the war and then once we're in the war. So I think Deer Hunter does not have the reputation it had. I think Michael Cimino, probably within film historiography, doesn't have the reputation he once had. But again, as I was saying before, for me, I think the film is almost more interesting in terms of what it's saying about working class life and people who are entrapped in the world of the steel mills. And there's a whole series of films that are very similar in that respect. And it can be films like Rocky, you know, stuck in the working class community of Philadelphia. All the Right Moves, Tom Cruise stuck in a small town, steel mill town in the 1980s. Flashdance, a woman stuck in the steel mills in Pennsylvania. And a number of these films are all about trying to get out or aspiring to something other. And Michael in Deer Hunter clearly wants something else. He's dissatisfied with the world around him. He's, in a kind of inarticulate way, is looking for something else. There's a scene right at the end of the wedding, about an hour into the film, where he strips off all his clothes and goes running through the town. And you just get a sense of he doesn't know what to do with himself. Many of the other figures, for example, Axel, a big brawling guy, sort of know what their life is, which is going to be drinking and sexing and things like that. But there's no way out for most of these guys. Vietnam might seem an alternative, but then it's simply a further twist, a further part of their entrapment. You know, the other controversy about Deer Hunter is the very end of the film. The survivors unite in a bar, and then they start singing God Bless America. And there's a debate about whether Chimina was being ironic or sort of saying that no matter how horrific things are, no matter the nightmares America goes through, we can still emerge with a kind of resilience, a can-do spirit. And that was another controversy of the film. It's a very strange way to end the film.
And that was the wonderful Dana Polan, who's a professor of cinema studies at New York University, talking to me earlier in the week. Now, we've been getting some wonderful texts in from our listeners on 53106. Brian in Killarney says that it's a great choice of topic, and he says that in terms of some of the controversies about the movie, the ends justifies the means with films, and his favourite scene is the spare boots one. And he says, I think we all know a character like Stanley. We certainly do. Someone else texted in to say, wondering would there be another great Vietnam film down the line, or has Hollywood moved on now? We were promised another one by Oliver Stone about My Lai, the massacre there, but it never came about because it's still viewed as a touchy subject, unlike other conflicts. Philip, what about that? You've interviewed Oliver Stone in terms of your own show and your own work, and talked to him about, because he served in Vietnam, unlike Chimino.
Yeah, I mean, he was very different from Chimino, and to some extent, Oliver Stone's experience is kind of supports Stephen's point of view. Oliver Stone, he did two tours of duty in Vietnam, and he was in Cambodia as well, and I met him in about 1986-87, and at that stage he had done Platoon, and Platoon won the Best Picture Oscar, I think, in that year. And he said I met him in his house in Santa Monica, and he had moved to the West Coast from the East Coast at that stage. He was the son of an economist of a Wall Street broker, and he actually went off to work for a group called the Free Pacific Institute, teaching in his late teens. So he went away from home quite early. And then he actually joined up. He applied to join up himself. He wasn't drafted or anything. And as I say, he served two tours of duty. And he told me that he was rendered psychotic. He was psychotic, he said, when he came back from Vietnam. And he reckoned that the cinema and lecturers like Martin Scorsese and people like that had lectured him at NYU, that they had basically saved him. Now, the interesting thing about him is that, okay, he's made, I think, four films on Vietnam, but as well, I think, overall, in a more sort of expanded sense, you could see him as a constant commentator on American foreign policy, right from movies like Salvador onwards.
All the way up to his new one is going to be about Edward Snowden. A quick one to you, Stephen. Martin has texted in to ask, do your contributors actually like this film? It sounds as if they think it's a waste of time.
No, I think we've got to clarify. I think you know, you can admire a film and not necessarily like it, and you can, you know, and I think there's a lot to admire in The Deer Hunter. I just think I have huge problems with it.
With the politics.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think it's up there with the Birth of a Nation. Technically, it is superb in terms of its racist portrayal of group
and
of
that
people.
Was a defense of the Ku Klux Klan. Back in 1915, but I thought it was gripping when I watched it last night. I thought it was very. I had my hand in front of my face for some of the Russian roulette scenes, and like you could feel the horror and the tension and all of that. I did find some of the cinematography a little pretentious, and some of the things Dana mentioned, the drops of wine on the wedding dress. Some of it maybe a little.
We'll call that heavy-handed. You know, okay. I think, you see, because the thing is, he suddenly cuts in for a very, very tight close-up of the dress. Mm. And it's like, bum, 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 bum. You know, you can almost hear Beethoven.
Well, it is a tight close-up, but it lasts for a couple of seconds.
That's right, yeah. But the rest of the film is shot almost in wide shot and long shot. I think it's important what Philip mentioning, and you mentioning Oliver Stone, is because Oliver Stone's character in Platoon, he's the only college-educated kid in the front line. And the rest of them are African-Americans, and they've all come from this...
That's the character played by Charlie Sheen.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think in that respect, Cimino did something very, very important, but it's the way he did it. I have grave reservations about
it. Could I just say about that point about Dana made about a way out? There's no sense at all in which Robert De Niro was actually looking for a way out in The Deer Hunter.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, our final break now. And when we come back, we look at the legacy of Deer Hunter. We'll debate whether it is indeed a great movie. And we'll talk about what happened to Michael Cimino afterwards. All coming up after the break.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back as we look at the legacy of the movie The Deer Hunter. I'm joined by Stephen Benedict, Dr. Con Holohan and Philip Malloy. Con, is it possible that Iraq will now take over as the focus for filmmakers who want to deal with recent conflicts and that, in a way, that's become the new Vietnam?
It's interesting to kind of look at the films that have been made about Iraq and maybe the war on terror more generally and compare them perhaps to Vietnam, because of course one of the differences is that in a sense that by the time the films we're talking about came out, like The Deer Hunter, Platoon, etc., the war in Vietnam was definitively over. And so the films became a look back and a kind of what have we learnt? I mean, There's a great shot at the end of Platoon where Charlie Sheen's character lifts up in a helicopter and the Adagio for Strings comes on the soundtrack, and he wonders about, you know, what have we learned? He says, I'm a child born of the two fathers, the two sergeants he served under in Vietnam. And really, that's what the film's about, ultimately. It's about how does America move on and how do we sort of make good our debt to the people who died in Vietnam. The difficulty with Iraq and more generally perhaps the war on terror is that it's a very poorly defined and sort of unending conflict. And so I think the films that have been made about it have almost struggled to really have coherent plots in some respect. Like films like Syriana, often they sort of take refuge in just this real dense complexity where it's very hard to really find a sort of overall significance to the film. Like, for example, Brian De Palma made a film called Redacted, and I think it's 2007, and which was about a U.S. massacre in Iraq. And he kind of substitutes gimmickry for any kind of significance. So the film is shot through lots of different media. So some of it is video diaries shot by the soldiers. Some of it is stuff posted online. And so you get all these different perspectives on the Iraq war, but overall, the film doesn't really add up to anything. And I think that sort of seems to be a feature of the films around the war on terror, is that they find it hard to find a perspective on the war that really says anything.
Very good. We're almost out of time, but June and Kildare has texted in, read The Deer Hunter. She grew up in middle America at the time the film takes place. For me, it is so relevant that it fills me with a raw sorrow every time. Well, thank you, June, for that. Hugh and Cork says that De Niro and Walken are the reasons The Deer Hunter lasts. Regardless of some exaggerated camera scenes, the film is a phenomenal work. I think we would agree with that. Mm. Stephen, will there be an Iraq movie similar to The Deer Hunter?
Well, I think we've already had it. American Sniper. You know, they're both obsessed with the single shot. Okay, they both begin in an idyllic America. You see them hunting. You see Bradley Cooper's character as a child hunting, and they're seen as almost like defenders of this great idea of America and also justice. And the important thing is they're hunting animals.
But
and then they go off to the war front and they treat the people they're fighting as animals.
I think Stephen, that's a literal sort of reading of the movie, and I don't think the movie deserves that.
I think it's
one of Eastwood's very best movie, and I think it deserves to be read in kind of cinematic terms.
Okay, Philip, maybe talk to us about what happened to Cimino afterwards. He made Heaven's Gate, it was a flop. He tried to make all these other movies, but I'm surprised that you know, in a way that having done one classic that won all the awards didn't compensate or mark out the one flop, and because other directors have recovered from flops.
But I mean, it was a hell of a flop. I mean, it was more than a flop. And one of the things about it as well, one of the problem things about it was he actually, he started to misrepresent himself, not just in terms of whether he served in Vietnam or not. I think generally speaking, he presented this kind of very kind of bloated view of himself generally and in the cinema. And one of the things, by the way, I referred to the commentary on the DVD, and he's interviewed on the commentary by a critic called F.X. Sweeney. And he keeps putting Sweeney down and making claims for himself that that obviously aren't true. I don't think it's fair actually to the Deer Hunter. I don't think it's fair to reassess it in terms of what wasn't achieved by Heaven's Gate.
Very good. Okay, Philip, a final question to you. Some critics still say it's a cinematic masterpiece. Others say that it's overinflated, that it's terrible, that it's an indulgent barf fest. That's what one English critic said recently, that it's rambling, self-indulgent. That seems to me probably too harsh. So where would you stand?
Well, it's very harsh and too harsh. And I still think, I like you, I looked at it last night again. And
that's,
I think,
see, we're doing our homework.
Yes, and I think it stands up.
Stephen?
Yeah, I think I'm going to sound like Eamon Dunphy. I don't think it's a great film. It has greatness in it. There's many, many great strengths in it.
But some of those players are great players. Meryl Streep, Christopher Walken, Robert De Niro.
They're
great.
They're very flat at the back.
Okay. Well, we have to leave on something more uplifting than that. And maybe that would be by playing out with the theme music from The Deer Hunter.
Gorgeous,
it's Stanley Myers' Cavatina, played by the classical guitarist John Williams, but known more famously as the theme from The Deer Hunter. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Stephen Benedict, film expert and broadcaster, Dr. Con Holohan of NUI Galway, Philip Malloy, presenter of The Picture Show, and Professor Dana Polan of NYU. I tell you, it even makes the ending sound much more melodic and beautiful. We'll be back next week as we look at some books to recommend for the summer. It's our final show before the summer. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together: Susan Call, our producer; Simon McGuire on research; Paul Murnoch on sound. Join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Thanks for listening to this News Talk 106 to 108 podcast. To download other programs or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.